Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome on a Labor Day Sunday. My goodness, I nearly forgot this was a holiday weekend. I stay so active in what I'm doing. I call it my labor of love. Indeed it is, and it keeps me busy every day, and it's the way I love to spend my days, including talking to wonderful guests like today, Dodger Mayo. Oh, I think listeners are pretty familiar with Dar. He's an activist. He's an independent award-winning journalist. He reported unembedded from Iraq, the ones who do it the other way are the people at Stutz Terkel, a fellow Chicago one of mine until he died a few years ago. A couple of years ago. I lose track of time. It goes by so fast. He referred to those other folks as in bed with journalists, in bed with journalists, and indeed they are. Most of them, but not Dar. And he was there over the period 2003 to 2005. His Dodger Mail's dispatches can be followed regularly on his website. It's Dodger Mail, DarJamail, Iraq.com. He wrote a book titled, I believe this is his latest book. I think it is your latest book, called The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. What a big, big topic. I know a couple of other people who have written on that topic as well, with a menu of how they can really struggle against doing this. Both wars are illegal, of course. Nobody should fight in them. And the Army, Fuel Manual 2710, in fact, says no one may obey an illegal law, and anyone doing it, from the lowliest private up to the President of the United States, is liable to be prosecuted for breaking the law. Well, you know, they'll go after the lowly privates, but they'll never go after the President and those folks. Dar, are we connected?
We are, Stephen. Good to be with you.
Oh, it's great being with you. Let me just say what you've been doing recently and then let you jump in, because the program is yours and I want you to explain what you've been doing. In an email I sent you a couple of weeks ago, I called you intrepid. From deserts to gulfs, we're going to talk about the gulf. And are you back from your mountain trip?
I am.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, from blazing, intolerable heat to toxic waters and shorelines that, my God, I can't imagine why anybody would want to live in now. To mountain. Did you do any mountain climbing?
I did. I just got back from a little vacation on Mount Rainier.
Oh, my goodness. I'm too old for that kind of stuff. But you spent a good deal of time down in the Gulf area. I know in Louisiana, I think in Mississippi, and you saw what was going on there firsthand. You talked to people affected, and you reported what you're not going to read in the New York Times, what you're not going to hear on CNN and the rest of the corporate media. It really is a horror story, and I'll just add one more thing. It's only beginning. It's only beginning. Oh, let me throw one statistic in that I saw in recent days. Everybody remembers the Chernobyl incident a couple of decades back in the Soviet Union. I saw a statistic, and of course we're talking about nuclear radiation, but it was in one place. This Gulf catastrophe contaminated a vast area. I think the entire shoreline of the Gulf the west coast of Florida, and I believe it's already come up the east coast. It is a nightmare. Well, I think it may have already contaminated, maybe to a lesser degree, all of the east coast. My God, this thing began back in April. The Chernobyl statistic there was that the people you never heard about, not the ones who were killed, gravely harmed initially that we knew about, the statistics that came out, but the cancer deaths alone, and the corporate media never reports this, nearly a million people have died. Now, just imagine 20 years from now, the number of cancer deaths and other diseases, or let's just say cancers and other diseases, from the vast contamination from what I call the greatest environmental crime in history. Dar, you saw it firsthand, and you talked to the people, something I haven't done. Talk about what you wrote about and saw and so on.
Well, Stephen, I think that you drawing that direct parallel to the cancer deaths from Chernobyl that we never hear about and how long it took for that to start to surface over time, and what we're looking at in the Gulf, and I've read the articles you've been writing about the Gulf disaster as well. I think that's so pertinent it hurts, basically, because that's what's going to happen. I mean, we have the federal government and state governments, and even a lot of the local governments down there are pushing forward as fast as they can, all because of economics, to make it look as though everything's fine, things are cleared up, most of the oil's gone, come on back, our seafood's back, our tourism's back. And yet, when you really look at the hard science on the ground, the little bit of independent science that is going on, as well as a little bit that folks like me have tried to throw our two cents in with getting a little bit of analysis done on some of the samples we've taken, is that the Gulf is, you know, the affected areas around the Macondo wellhead and then much of the coast that you just mentioned, it really is a dead zone. I mean, we had even Mississippi's Department of Marine Resources go out and sample their oyster beds a few days ago. 90% of them are dead. 90% of the oyster harvest in Mississippi is already dead. And as you said, this thing's just starting. When I've gone around the Gulf and talked to people in Louisiana, Mississippi, primarily those two states because they're the two most heavily impacted so far, but also in Alabama and parts of Florida, you know, I'm hearing the same thing, is that, okay, first of all, we still have massive amounts of oil washing ashore in the form of tar balls or the so-called dispersed oil. And the problem is that so much of this, you can't see it. These chemicals are in the water. They're in the seafood. It's already making its way far up the food chain, and it's very, very insidious. And so even though, okay, you're not pulling a fish out and it's soaked in black crude oil, you might have a fish that visible signs, and even if you smell it, you're not going to be able to tell that it's heavily contaminated with oil and or dispersant. But we're talking about industrial solvents and methane and hexane and things like this, which are extremely carcinogenic, and this speaks directly to what you just talked about, drawing that parallel to Chernobyl, where just because you can't see it and smell it and taste it doesn't mean it's not there. And I think your analogy is perfect, and I think we're going to be looking at the same thing here. And I'll draw another direct parallel, that to the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil disaster, where the cleanup workers there that also worked amongst, you know, there was a heavy use of dispersants there as well. Of all the cleanup workers in that oil disaster, so far none of them have lived past the age of 51 years old.
It really is shocking, Darren. If you go back, Exxon Valdez, 1989, I believe. You go back there now, Prince William Sound, and you dig into the sand on the beaches and go below the rocks, and you're going to find oil, and that stuff is going to be there a generation from now. And by the way, the state of Alaska, I mentioned this in one of the articles I wrote, the state of Alaska conservatively estimated that the amount of that spill from the ship was three times what Exxon reported. Now just imagine what the true figure is from the BP disaster, and there's still leakage. Nobody knows how much. There's still leakage from that Macondo well, and we miss him, this fellow Matt Simmons, who believed that the well was gushing something like 120,000 gallons a day. Is it gallons or barrels?
Barrels.
Barrels. 100,000 barrels a day. I mean, we're talking something like three or four Exxon Valdez incidents every single week. Every single week. Just imagine how much of the Gulf is contaminated. I think anybody who eats any seafood from the southern part of this country, and I dare say maybe a whole long distance beyond the southern part, but just anything from the Gulf, I think you have to be nuts. You are eating poisoned food, and you'll harm yourself over time. You won't know about it for a while. Nothing may happen. And then you may get sick 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 years from now, and you'll never have any idea that all that damn stuff that you ate that was contaminated is what caused this for you. And that's what's going on in the Gulf.
That's right. And I've gone out personally with commercial shrimpers who, needless to say, their entire livelihood is based on basically having seafood to harvest and healthy, uncontaminated seafood. And I've gone out on boats with these guys, and they know better than anyone that you know how important it is to have seafood and have it be clean, and they are protesting the federal and state government's push to open these waters because they know, look, they told me, look, if we go out and shrimp and we put contaminated shrimp on the market and someone eats it and gets sick or finds it, our livelihood is done. I mean, it would take us decades to recover from that kind of PR. And they understand that, and they're the ones that are actually actively trying to do their own studies, bring out scientists, bring out journalists, show people that it's still contaminated, show people that you can't open the waters yet to fish, and these are the people doing it. So, you know, I've actually had some feedback on some of my articles saying, oh, well, you're overreacting, and it's not that bad, and, you know, I just defer straight to the fishermen, and there's commercial fishermen now in Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida, and they're all saying the same thing, and I'm talking about groups including thousands of fishermen, okay, and their families that are saying, look, it's not safe, we need more testing, we can't fish yet, and those that have gone out and tried to fish in the waters that have been opened by the feds and the state governments have basically reported we're either catching literally nothing or we're catching maximum one-fifth of what we usually would catch this time of year. And for example, I went out on a boat out of Fouchon, Louisiana, nearby Grand Isle, and as we were leaving the port and going out the canal into the Gulf, we passed, this was on the 16th of last month, the day that Louisiana had just reopened some of their fishing areas for shrimping. And we passed two shrimpers coming in. One of them literally caught nothing, and the other one caught 12 shrimp, as in one dozen shrimp. Not pounds, not hundreds of pounds, but 12 shrimp. And normally they would catch anywhere from between 700 pounds and 1,000 pounds per go.
Again, it's the reason I call it the greatest ever environmental crime. And I just hope someday we'll know just how bad this was. You know, once it leaves the news, Dar, I mean, one crime compounds another crime. It's not a news story anymore. I mean, this thing is an ongoing disaster that will go on year after year after year. And now it's a non-news story. And a little aside, we had another rig blow up and a big fire. They apparently put it out in 6 hours. And the company, a small company, Marin Energy, they lied and they said there was no spill. Well, there was a spill. The Coast Guard, which is nothing but a branch of BP in the oil industry, just like the Obama administration, is really just a subsidiary of the oil industry when it comes to drilling offshore or on land. So they lie for the industry. The Coast Guard put out a report initially, somebody screwed up there, and they said there was a leak 100 miles long and 100 feet wide. Well, miraculously, on the same day, they came out with another report, and they said there was no leak.
Right. I was following that. Actually, they said it was a mile long and 100 feet wide, and this was basically immediately after they discovered, okay, there was an explosion and a fire and some big problems there, and all the 13 rig folks were in the water waiting to be picked up. And I watched that very closely, too, how the initial reports were, yes, there's oil on the water, there's a sheen, and then immediately see that erased from the headlines. And, you know, it's really interesting to watch the news and how they try to manage it in this way. And, you know, we've seen them do this in Iraq time and time and time again with the deaths of soldiers and other situations. And now we see it playing out in the Gulf. And it's really amazing to me to see it right here, front line in the United States of America, where people can see it for themselves and see these contradictions. And I think the point, talking about Coast Guard complicity with BP, along with the state governments and the federal government for that matter, where I don't think it could have been made any more obvious to people when you have the President of the United States, Barack Obama, go down and do a photo op in the Gulf, in the water. It wasn't actually on the coast. It was in one of the back bays, for the record. But getting in the water with his little daughter, I mean, it was as though BP called the federal government and said, hey, you know what, we need some really serious PR now. Can we get the president in the water with his daughter? Because that's the kind of message we need people to understand now, so we can get back to business as usual and continue on drilling in the Gulf. And we have the federal government complying with that. And the same, NOAA, NIOSH, OSHA, the Coast Guard, we can go on down a long laundry list of federal agencies that are all completely complicit in this, and the Coast Guard being, at this point, you know, one of the worst. I mean, they're the ones who've consistently denied the use that any dispersants have been used in the Gulf since, I believe it was July 16th, which is actually absolutely absurd. I mean, I have countless eyewitnesses, photographic proof that the opposite is true, that they've continued to be used even right now, all along, anywhere any kind of oil pops up at all. BP calls in the sprayers, and they come in with the Corexit, and they spray the heck out of the stuff to sink it. And that has been the policy from day one, and that continues now, and that will continue until basically no more is popping up. And this couldn't happen without full government complicity.
Oh, government complicity is right, and of course, the Obama administration, just like Bush, Republicans and Democrats, not a dime's worth of difference between them. They are literally in the pocket of all the big corporate interests. So I think there's a little bit of a pecking order, Dar. There's no question that Wall Street is at the head of the pecking order. But then you've got big oil, you've got the defense contractors, you've got big pharma, you've got the insurance companies. I put out an article today. There was a story that came out a few weeks ago, but there's a lawsuit that was announced at the end of August that Prudential and MetLife and other insurance companies are ripping off the benefits of dead war vets. we poison them in what people eat. These kids that go to fight a war based on a lie, they die or they get maimed for life. Well, mean for life, you don't collect your life insurance. But I mentioned one article that was on a woman written about, collected a $400,000 policy, but she didn't have it. It was put in some kind of an account she thought was a bank account until she went to try to cash a check and nobody would cash it because it wasn't a check. And the insurance companies are ripping off these beneficiaries of their dead sons and daughters, well, mostly sons, some daughters, I imagine, investing the money, getting whatever yield they get on the money, and paying virtually nothing. 1%, half of 1%, maybe a fraction of a half of 1% to the beneficiaries, and they didn't even know it. I mean, stealing from the graves is what I call it. So crime upon crime upon crime, Dar, and try finding this story anywhere in the corporate media, and that second Mariner accident, that was a one-day story. It wasn't even a one-day story. It popped up in the news, and I think it disappeared. And the next day, I believe it was gone. And who knows how bad that thing really was. We know the way BP lied at the beginning, from 1,000 barrels to 60,000 barrels, and probably at a minimum it was at least 120,000 barrels. And Mariner said there was nothing. Now we know there was something. The question is, well, how much something has come out? Is it still coming out? Is there a risk? These workers on this platform, Dar, after the explosion, they had to dive into the water to save their lives. So it was nothing to take life?
That's right. And, you know, I mean, I think all of this just really just underscores the fact that, you know, I think, well, let me back up a little bit. I mean, if there was any silver lining to the Bush administration at all, is it really ripped off and shredded the mask that was, whatever was left of the mask of the U.S. empire. That if anyone had any doubt left in their mind that we don't live in an empire, a corporate-driven empire, the Bush administration effectively did away with that. And I think if there's any silver lining to this whole BP disaster is that, you know, any line that may have existed between the government and corporations, any line of separation is gone. That we basically, I don't know how much more clear it could possibly be made now, that corporations literally run the government. And in the example of BP in the Gulf disaster, I think that's been made abundantly clear. I honestly don't see how it could be any more clear that corporations are calling all the shots, they're running the government, and the government is basically acting as their errand boy at this point, whether it comes to total deregulation or, you know, holding them responsible for any accidents to, you know, the governments are the ones leading the charge to open everything back up and start serving people contaminated seafood. I mean, that couldn't be any more clear. And so I think that leaves us all in a position where we have to face the fact that we are really on our own, that there is no government that represents us. There's no government that's going to step in and assist us or be a regulator of corporate power in any way or corporate pollution, that we really, really, truly are now on our own. And I think that's a hard fact to hear, and I think it's one that all of us needs to kind of sit with and let it sink in, and we need to absorb that and then begin to understand that and start to behave accordingly.
Dar, you're 100% right. It's shocking, but it's true. And regular listeners to this program know it and understand it. That government is not our friend. Government is not our ally. And it doesn't make any difference whether we're talking about George Bush or Barack Obama. And in the case of Obama, it really is a shame to think that we finally got a black president. My goodness. I mean, we really broke a barrier, a ceiling. Now let's get a woman president. I'm sure there will be at some point in time. Unfortunately, it will not be the kind of person that we want to be our leader. That person, just like the ones we have now, will be our enemies, not our friends. And again, I mean, they're in the pocket of the corporate interests. And it goes throughout all branches of government, Gar. I mean, the Congress, obviously, the administration, and the Supreme Court. You reminded me of an article I wrote over a year ago. I called it Supreme Court Inc., meaning the decisions that our Supreme Court hands down, including a lullapalooza for ExxonMobil, slashing the original benefits to 10%. Of what they initially were, if I remember the numbers, $5 billion in damages down to $500 million. And it took 20 years or so before that decision was made. So think of all the money Exxon made before the decision was even made and how they dispensed that money to whom. Who's still alive to get any money? Who even knows about it after 20 years? But the Supreme Court is in the pocket of big corporate interests. The entire government is in the pocket of big corporate interest. And again, it's a shame there. I mean, we hold our country up to be a model that the rest of the world should emulate. God help the rest of the world if they copy what we do.
That's right. I mean, this country at this point has really been an experiment in what happens when you take garden variety capitalism and turn it into total corporate capitalism and then throw off all the regulations and let it run all the way to the bitter end. And we are at that end. And I think the Gulf of Mexico really kind of physicalizes that aspect where, you know, we can have a corporate power, the single largest supplier of oil to the Pentagon, be drilling in extremely dangerous conditions, had long since thrown all regulations out the window, drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, and then have this massive disaster that is effectively intensely polluted the ninth largest body of water on the planet. And not only are they getting away with it, but, you know, as I'm sure you're all too aware of this too, Stephen, but, you know, we saw this well over a month ago, that they decided, hey, we're going to write the whole thing off on our taxes, meaning that that gyps the U.S. taxpayer out of tax money that would have been generated by the oil that they were bringing up. So effectively, taxpayers are footing the entire bill, the loss that BP suffered. And it's going to be really interesting to see, you know, them come out and say, you know, it's not out of the realm of possibility that they may well profit from this. And that's certainly exactly their goal. By having Ken Feinberg, the payment czar, the guy on BP's payroll, admits it himself, although he won't talk about how much he's being paid by BP, to be the person responsible for dispensing the $20 billion so-called compensation fund. And yet, as we speak, talking to commercial fishermen and others, people around the Gulf who are either not getting compensation whatsoever, and even those who've been approved for compensation, if they get their checks are literally bouncing. So, again, all of this, I mean, we can go through one example after another of how, you know, corporations are going to do what they're going to do, and they're going to do what serves their bottom line, as is stated by the corporate charter. So this shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone. They are beholden by law to generate profits for their shareholders at all costs. I mean, that's what they're going to do. They're going to behave accordingly, and that should not come as a surprise. But I think what people need to understand is we have a government now that is basically acting completely in their interests, and they're going to do whatever is necessary to back corporations in that goal. And if that means at the expense of completely polluting the ninth largest body of water on the planet and killing over time hundreds of thousands of Americans in the process, then so be it.
So be it indeed. You really shocked me with that one comment. Checks are actually checks coming from BP bouncing?
That's correct. And that's happening so far, I know for sure, in Louisiana and in Alabama, if not in other states as well.
Any idea what's going on?
No, that's what people are asking. They're wanting me to write about it. I've got to call a guy this afternoon, actually, over in Alabama and talk about this, because he was, you know, he went through the formal process. He filled out all the paperwork, and he was told, yes, you're going to get this much compensation, and this is what it's for because of your loss of livelihood for these months. And then when he got the check, it literally bounced. So that's what folks are dealing with.
That sounds like what I wrote about with Prudential, people, beneficiaries of the dead war vets, getting a policy. They thought they had a bank account. They got something that looked like a checkbook there, but it wasn't a checkbook. So when they went to write a check, it bounced. It wasn't any good. Oh, my good. Let's take a brief break, Dar, bottom of the hour. I'll let you catch your breath. Think about continuing on the bounce chip topic and other information on the Gulf contamination and where you're going now in writing more about this. Let's take a brief break, and we'll be right back.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Eric Davis, host of Expanding Mind. Join me and co-host Maja Daou each week as we explore the culture of consciousness, spirituality, neuroscience, media tech, and all manner of wonders and esoterica. Expanding Mind streams every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your mind open.
Acclaimed theoretical physicist Dr. Michio Kaku hosts Explorations, with topics ranging from the physics of gravity to the ever-expanding universe. With his lighthearted personality and natural charisma, Dr. Kaku breaks down intricate theories with a comprehensible approach. He's one of the greatest popularizers of science, who will take you on a fascinating journey into the world of scientific understanding. So let's take an exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku every Tuesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Mike Adams, the editor-in-chief and key writer of naturalnews.com and co-founder of the nonprofit site consumerwellness.org. I'll be starting a special segment on the Progressive Radio Network called The Health Ranger with Mike Adams. I'll be interviewing everyone from Dr. Jane Goodall to Suzanne Summers. Find out the latest in natural healing news and easy ways to live a healthier and more holistic lifestyle. So tune in on Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern every week on the Progressive Radio Network to hear The Health Ranger with Mike Adams.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back on With Dodge and Mail. It's amazing, Dar. I have an hour program on the weekends on Thursdays, 30 minutes, and the time literally evaporates, and these topics are so big. The kind of topics that I know I wish, I don't have a limitless time, but just to discuss them as fully as possible, to sit around and literally, like a whole afternoon, and have a detailed conversation on just what this thing is and all the threads and what it means and the kind of stuff that you just never get in the dominant media. Not one part of the dominant media will give it to you. You know the big money guys, the corporate media. But the corporate media is also NPR and PBS, and you go over the Atlantic to the UK, and you've got BBC, which is owned and operated by the UK government. What kind of a news service do you think that's going to be? They're not going to say anything nasty about their own owner, just the way NBC won't say anything nasty about GE. Let me give you another thread, Dara, on the BP story. Another guest on this program, a former insider, who's a glorious, glorious woman, Catherine Austin Fitz. One day I heard her talk about a man she called Stanley the Fixer. Stanley the Fixer, that's probably a name most listeners don't know, Stanley Sporkin. We did discuss him on one program back, so anybody who heard the program may remember Stanley Sporkin. He is a consummate insider. He worked for the CIA. He was a federal judge. He's a CPA. I mean, he is a big deal guy, and he happens to be the ombudsman for BP. Well, I think everybody knows what an ombudsman is supposed to do. He's supposed to do for people with issues at BP what Ken Feinberg, Dar, is supposed to do for the affected people down in the Gulf. He's supposed to represent them. But Sporkin doesn't give a damn about BP employees, except, you know, the ones who are vice presidents, those kind of people. They're the people he's there to help. He is a BP fixer. My article was called, what was the title? Stanley Sporkin, BP's ombudsman fixer. He's working for BP. He's not working for the workers. So Ken Feinberg, the same thing, Dar, and he played the same role.
going back a great many years in the past, is affecting victims of Agent Orange from Vietnam. The company that made the Dalkon shield, the women who were so affected by that, and his job was to cheat them out of everything he could, deny as many people as possible anything, give those who got any compensation the barest bones amounts to save the company as much money as possible. He saved the Dalkon shield maker from bankruptcy by cheating its victims. He was also involved in the post 9/11 environmental contamination to screw the people who were affected by that. And of course, there was a massive cover up on just how bad that was. Loads and loads of people got sick, and his job was literally to cheat them out of what was coming to them. So that's exactly what his job is in treating the people affected by the BP disaster. A few more thoughts on that, Dar?
Well, yeah, another thing we need to remember about Ken Feinberg, and, you know, this is a story that really makes my blood boil, because people along the Gulf Coast have suffered dramatically, particularly those involved in the commercial fishing industry, and now here's this guy, and I love that you call him BP's fixer, because that's exactly what the guy is. I mean, he's paid by BP. When he was pressed on by a reporter doing his job and asked him, well, how much are you being paid by BP? He said, quote, that's between me and BP, end quote. And, you know, that this whole thing is between him and BP. I mean, it's, if anyone really thinks this guy has their best interests in mind, if you need to wake up and smell the coffee, that this guy's sole job is to save BP as much money, to limit their liability as much as possible. I mean, I'm all too familiar with Mr. Feinberg, because not too long after he became the so-called payment czar, it was revealed to me by a law firm in New Orleans that actually had an email, and I actually have a copy of the document. They sent it to me between their law firm and BP's lawyer from back on May 3rd, where on May 3rd, and we're talking very soon after this disaster started, that BP's lawyer sent this law firm in New Orleans a written statement saying we would not deduct from any future compensation claims people in the Vessels of Opportunity program, the people, the commercial fishermen hired by BP to go out and theoretically pick up the oil, clean up the oil, that payment would not be deducted from any future compensation claims. And BP has changed their stance on that and said, no, we are going to deduct that. And they've put Ken Feinberg out there on point, saying that very thing. No, you know, we will be deducting that. And in fact, the way they're working this situation, and this is another thing that commercial fishermen are up in arms about, is that here's what they're going to do, is you have to prove your last 3 years of income, keeping in mind the commercial fishing industry in the Gulf. Most of these folks don't exactly, it's a largely a cash economy. They don't exactly use QuickBooks. They're out on their shrimpers, they're trawling, they're making ends meet, making enough to feed their families, and that's about it. But they're not exactly keeping tight books. And so this is, of course, all understood by Ken Feinberg and BP. So what these people are supposed to do is they're supposed to take their last 3 years of income and give all that paperwork to BP and prove their income, and then BP takes the lowest year of money they made out of those 3 years, and then that's what they're going to get compensated for if they have all their paperwork in order. So we can see going into this that the deck is clearly stacked against them. And then, of course, if they happen to work in BP's Vessels Opportunity Program, as most commercial fishermen did, because it was literally their only source of income, then that money would be deducted from any claim that you make, whether it's for that 1 year of lost income or any future health claims on down the road. So we've seen BP take a page out of the Exxon playbook from 1989 and just run with it. From the very beginning, in the first week, after this disaster started, BP was going around the Gulf buying up all the scientists, making generous contributions to different universities along the Gulf to try to sway what their studies and scientific papers would be covering regarding this disaster. I mean, from the very beginning, it's been all about minimizing their liability, buying people off, getting people not to talk who would normally be used to talk against them, and they've been very, very effective at it.
And they make so much money, Dar, that I think the bottom line for BP will be that they had one bad quarter, and that will be their bottom, and then they'll be begin to be resurrected from that. Let me mention one other thing, too, because I just got an email with a brand-new article that you wrote that I didn't know about, and I haven't had a chance to read it yet. It's dated today, and you call it Life Versus Productivity. What you live and die to protect, what would you live and die to protect? You want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, you didn't have a chance to read it because I literally just had it published.
It literally popped up about 30 seconds ago.
That's about right. Yeah, I literally just sent that out right before we got on the phone here. And basically, it's an article that's based quite heavily on an interview I did with a man named Derek Jensen, who is a radical environmental activist and author who lives in Northern California. And I expect the article to raise a lot of debate because this is a guy who's basically openly calling for militant resistance against what we've been talking about. And it's basically a think piece to try to get the debate going and get people thinking about different kinds of resistance. It's not a piece where I intentionally advocated any kind of resistance over another, but it basically lines out a lot of the different types of resistance going on in the environmental community right now with regards to climate change and other things like the BP disaster. And it's basically a piece where, you know, Jensen is a very radical figure. He does generate a lot of controversy because he confronts people, I think, with if you want to talk about resistance, let's really talk about it. And basically he says things like, look, riding a bicycle and recycling and composting is all great and we should all do it, but if you want to talk about real resistance, that really doesn't count. That if you want to really talk about what needs to be done to stop these people, then that's what we need to talk about. Because he talks about the fact that, you know, Hitler was almost assassinated in 1939, and everyone agrees that if Hitler was assassinated in 1939, the war probably doesn't happen. And so we can look then at what would have been saved by that. And that's his point. Yeah, obviously it's very controversial. He openly calls for assassinations and other types of militant resistance. And I'm not saying that I advocate that, but I'm saying that it's very important that people start thinking like members of a resistance. And that means doing types of direct actions, shutting things down, more effective organized strikes, and other things as well. So I hope people read it, and if nothing else, it just gets folks thinking about what type of resistance might really be necessary on a national level to stop a continuance of all the things that we've been talking about here today.
I'm very much an advocate of the nonviolent type of resistance, Dar. I believe that violence only begets more violence, but resistance is a key word. The only times we've ever seen real change, important change in this country, and it's a theme that I've touched on a number of times on past programs, when enough people, and it absolutely does not need to be a majority, it can be a fairly small number of absolutely committed people to change, and they keep working for it, and they don't quit, and maybe they don't succeed, but they pass the ball to others who continue the battle. And my God, I mean, we ended up ending slavery in this country. It took women 100 years to get the right to vote. Our founding fathers were certainly a far cry from the bunch that we have today, but they didn't think that women should have the right to vote. Jefferson didn't think so. Adams didn't think so. Washington didn't think so. My goodness. Well, Adams and Jefferson weren't in Philadelphia, but we'll lump them in. I mean, they were both presidents. My God, why shouldn't women be allowed to vote? Of course, these same people didn't think black people were people. They thought they were property, and it goes on and on and on like that. But remarkable things have happened, Dar. Not enough And the other side of that lesson is, no matter what you achieve, if you don't keep struggling for it, you lose it. So we had some important civil rights gains in the 1960s, and do I ever remember them? They're gone. They are literally gone, and I have read, and I've quoted, and I've written that those gains that were made in the 1960s, we're right back to where we were there then, and in a lot of respects, we're even worse off today than we were then. Oh, I think we are worse off than then because we've offshored our manufacturing base. I mean, my God, I mean, poor black people in the South, if they didn't find opportunities there, Dar, they could come up north and get a job with GM or Ford or Chrysler and earn three or four times what they could make doing God only knows down south with not as much industry. Well, those jobs are gone now. Or the ones that are here, they're paying a pittance compared to what they paid 30 years ago.
Well, and I think, you know, it's a situation where we need to look at, I agree with what you said insofar as, you know, people like Howard Zinn, who, you know, just such a model figure of continuing the struggle throughout your entire life and staying radical and not compromising. And, you know, this is a guy who really is a fine example for all of us to follow. And then I would add to that a strong suggestion made by Dr. Ricky Ott, the toxicologist and author and Exxon Valdez survivor who's been working down in the Gulf nonstop from the second this disaster started on to help organize people and educate them about what they're going to need to do to take care of themselves in the wake of this disaster. And one of the things she calls for is she said, look, if we want to really have a shot at changing things, the first thing we have to do is abolish corporate personhood. That once corporations had the same rights as individuals in the U.S., we basically lost the war, and that we don't have any hope of regaining a level playing field and having a chance of changing things unless we can immediately abolish corporate personhood. And I would completely agree with her. But, and again, I'm not going to pretend to have answers to these. I have, I think, more questions than answers right now. But then that really begs the question is, in this system, as you mentioned earlier, you know, Supreme Court Inc., do we really have a chance at abolishing corporate personhood? And if not, what do we do instead? And how do we react? And what other kinds of resistance are there and available to us that might be effective? And I'm not going to pretend to have any answers or advocate one thing over another, but I think these are really, really important questions that all of us need to be having serious discussions and debates about right now. And I think one thing that's really different is that, you know, our system is completely co-opted, and, you know, we need to start looking at that very soberly and honestly. And because until we do that, until people are still running around thinking that writing a letter to their senator is actually going to make some kind of a difference, we're just not going to get very far.
Oh, absolutely. And still the people who believe in Obama and think that he really is different, they're living in a dream world. They literally are living in a dream world, including intelligent people who believe that, well, you know, he won't be perfect, but he sure will be a lot different than George Bush. Oh, my goodness, I knew right away that was a pipe dream. That Supreme Court decision, I've written about it a few times back in 1886 or somewhere around that time, and the Supreme Court didn't even make the decision. It was Southern Pacific Railroad versus Santa Clara County. It was a property dispute, and the court clerk, my God, I still remember his name, J. Bancroft Davis, he put an addendum on the Supreme Court decision giving corporations personhood, but I believe the whole thing was rigged, and it was in cahoots with the justices who maybe decided this was the way they would do it. Corporations had wanted this for so long, and it basically gave them all the rights of human beings, all of our rights we supposedly get in our Constitution and Bill of Rights. Well, they in fact get them, and we in fact do not get them. But they have none of the liabilities. And, of course, we have the liabilities. So if you and I commit capital murder, say, Dar, they can execute us. Well, if a corporation kills a lot of people, well, just maybe, it's a very long maybe, that you could hold
one or more of its officials accountable, but you don't hold the corporation accountable. I mean, the corporation could kill a million people. The corporation tomorrow will be the same as it is today. And just maybe, well, the corporate executives won't be hung out to dry. Maybe some lower-level people in the company might be somewhat hung out to dry. And then the Supreme Court will say, oh, we found a flaw in the case against them, and they'll let the guy off the hook. This Canadian media baron, Conrad Black, it just happened with him, stealing the guy from Enron. Enron, they ruined the lives of, I don't know how many millions of people, their employees, their shareholders. And it was nothing but a crime syndicate, because BP is a crime syndicate too, Dar. they pose as corporations, but they're really crime syndicates. They're mafia bosses.
That's exactly right. And, you know, with the full backing, of course, of the U.S. government, because everyone's been paid off and palms greased accordingly, you know. And you know, it's depressing as this information is, I mean, I think it's important that we talk about it, important that we all look very soberly and clearly at exactly what is our situation and what are we up against. Because what's amazing is you can go across the globe and go over the Middle East, for example, and everyone over there is very clear about our government and how it works, and, you know, democracy is a sham and that it's corporate-driven and it's a war profiteering, money-grubbing, corporate-driven government, and that's the fuel of its policies and the determining factor of its policies. And people, you know, from school kids on up are very clear about this, and I think, you know, one of the other things working against us here is that so many people still maintain this illusion in their heads that we live in a democracy, or that, like you mentioned earlier, you know, intelligent people that still think Obama, you know, is going to do anything positive in this situation. And I think a lot of that is, or some of that problem comes from, we do have a history where we have had these successful social movements, and we have been able to force our government to do different things. And, you know, we need to just be really honest that right now, while that's not out of the realm of possibility, what would be necessary to galvanize enough people to start behaving in the same way in such a large, powerful movement to force something like that, like starting with the abolishment of corporate personhood or abolishing lobby groups, which in other countries are called bribery institutions, and they're illegal. But, you know, these types of things that would have to happen to have a representative government in this country that's not totally politically in a corporate way corrupted, that these are the type of things that would need to happen. So I think we need to really be honest about the true dire nature of the predicament that we're in. And, of course, all of this, again, so perfectly, you know, made so clearly by the situation in the Gulf of Mexico, by BP, and now, of course, BP stating, as it just came out in the last couple of days, that if they're not allowed to continue their drilling operations in the Gulf, then that's going to jeopardize the compensation fund. So literally, just I like that you call them a mafia, because, you know, what mafia would behave differently? Hey, if you don't do this, we're going to exert a little pressure on you, if you know what I mean.
And whatever harm mafia bosses can do in their territories, are it's pocket change compared to what these great corporate oligopolistic, what's the adjective? Well, these giant corporate entities conspiring with each other, interlocked on their boards of directors, so it's not just the oil industry or what I call big oil or big pharma or the big defense contractors, but they're all interlinked with other companies. So they'll sit on the boards of the big media companies. I mean, imagine a defense contractor sitting on the board of CNN, sitting on the board of a pharmaceutical company, sitting on the board of an agribusiness company, and they literally do control things. It's their money that buys the best government. They buy what Greg Palast says. They buy the best democracy money can buy, because of their money. Unless we take money out of politics, there is no chance of getting a decent government. And I honestly say, I don't believe there is one single member of Congress, not even one, who is what I would call true blue. And the two that I thought were the best proved it to me,
because when the rubber met the road, they caved and they voted on things they absolutely denounced until the moment of truth, the final vote, and I'm talking about Bernie Sanders in the Senate, Dennis Kucinich in the House. I've mentioned their names on this program before. Kucinich is the only member of Congress I ever invited on this program, and I'm talking about so-called health care reform that is a complete and utter scam. It's a scam. It's a gift to the big insurers, to the big drug companies, and why not? They wrote the damn bill. They wrote the bill to give them what they want, and the public is being scammed, and we'll find out about it incrementally over time, and people will then realize that they'll end up getting less, paying more, and those two people in Congress that denounced the process all the way through month after month, they ended up voting for it. Well, that told me that they are all corrupted. They're all in the pocket of big money interests. We need a complete makeover, Doc. We literally need to deconstruct the system, take the present edifice and literally tear it down to the ground and rebuild from scratch, including a new constitution, I think. We have a lot of good things in our constitution, but it's not good enough, and the language isn't clear enough. Clear enough to me. But it's unclear in the sense that there are loopholes to be exploited. It needs to be changed. We can do it. The Jefferson believed we should have a revolution every 25 years, not blood in the streets. But that things change, which is what he meant. Things change. The country changes. We need to go back, and we need to fine-tune and update. We have never done that, except for the amendments to the Constitution. I think we need to start all over again there, because we certainly don't have a democracy.
I totally agree, and we are long overdue for a major house cleaning in this country on a governmental level.
Can I add one more thing? We have an election coming up in November. I think anybody who votes for a single Democrat or Republican is out of their minds. I urge everybody listening to this program, if you want to vote, vote. Vote independent. Your candidate won't win. But if you vote Democrat or Republican, you won't win. I haven't voted Democrat or Republican in as far back as I can remember. I don't know of anybody worth voting for. And my congressman, Dar, is a guy who on the whole is better than the average. But he voted for health care reform. He voted for financial reform, another scam. So he certainly doesn't represent me. And he's a black guy representing an awful lot of black people in his district. He certainly does not serve their interest, just the way Obama has thumbed his nose at the mass of black voters who may on their own have put him over the top.
Yeah, and I mean, that should be a lesson for people, you know, because it's irrelevant, you know, whether someone's black, white, male, female, brown, yellow, whatever. I mean, it's completely irrelevant. I mean, the one thing we need to look, if you're looking at voting for anybody, is, you know, what are their corporate interests? Where are their campaign contributions from? Who do they represent? What lobby groups are behind these people? And all this information, at least for now, thankfully, is readily available online, and it's not too hard to find. There's plenty of websites out there that track people's campaign contributions, and yeah, as you point out, just about everybody is corrupted. I think everybody is in the federal government in any position of power. The question is just to what extent and by whom exactly. And so I think this is what people need to take into account when we talk about the midterm elections coming up or the presidential elections 2 years from then is, you know, do you know, given that playing field, do you really think your vote's going to be worthy of generating change that has to happen in this country?
Absolutely. Martin Luther King had it right. It's not the color of the skin that matters. It's the content of the character. And I'm afraid that there's not much of that character in anybody in Congress. Doc, give them your website one more time. And I can't believe this hour is over with.
It's simply dar.org, D-A-H-R.org.
Oh,
we'll
that's
get
simple.
Folks there.
That
yeah.
is simple. I tell people to access my blog by doing it the way I do it, Steve Lenman blog. I bring it up easily that way all the time. All my articles here in chronological order. I urge people to take a look at it. Oh, we're out of time, Dar. I hope you'll come back soon, and we'll pick this up. I know you're going to be following the Gulf. and lots more. I follow all of your articles. They are absolutely marvelous. You are a tribute to real journalism. I salute you.
Thanks again, Steve, and likewise.
Thanks, sir. Join us again next Thursday, 11 a.m. Eastern, weekends 1 p.m. Eastern. Make it a regular habit.